Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
When you look at where we're at, this June strength is pretty atypical relative to, you know, where we were in May and the strength we've seen. So I think it gives me a much more positive outlook, at least for this summer, than I would have told you a couple of weeks ago.
Iowa State livestock economist Lee Schultz.
Now, certainly last week's trade was a big part of that, and some of the appreciation in those values certainly helped that. But realizing there's some really good fundamentals here. I think even though we have record inventories of cattle on feed, they are rather current. And so that's certainly helping the market. And the ability to operate these processing plants at a rather brisk pace has really helped. Now, demand is really pulling those cattle, I think, through the system. And the reason why we've seen those brisk rates.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
As many of you know, the primary focus of AFPC has been to analyze the likely consequences of policy changes at the farm level with our one-of-a-kind data set of information that we collect from commercial farmers and ranchers located across the United States.
Dr. Joe Outlaw, co-director of the Ag and Food Policy Center at Texas A&M, testifying recently before the House Ag Committee.
Working closely with 675 commercial producers has provided our group with a unique perspective on agricultural policy. Currently, we maintain the information to describe and simulate 94 representative crop and livestock operations in 30 states. In order to provide perspective on Titles 1 and 11, I wanted to briefly summarize a recent report that looks at farm profitability in 2021 relative to 2022 relative to 21 for our 64 representative crop farms in the face of higher input and output prices. For this report, we asked our panel members to provide their cost per acre for each of those years. While some producers were able to benefit by locking in input prices early in 2021 for this year's crop, most indicated very little ability to do so. The news is full of stories about inflation that is averaging 8.5% so far this year for the average American. The lowest year-over-year inflation farmers are seeing is twice that on seed, with most commodity categories many times higher. The following are highlights of the analysis that are relevant for today's hearing. Net cash farm income in 2021 included a significant amount of ad hoc assistance. Absent another infusion in 2022, we estimate that significant increases in input prices will result in a decline in net cash farm income in 2022 relative to 21. However, despite the income reduction from 21, most crops will likely still result in positive net cash farm income for the representative crop farms. The noticeable outlier is rice. Two-thirds of rice farms are facing losses in 2022. Having worked with farmers over the last 30 years, I want to make sure you understand we are talking about historic amounts of capital that farmers are putting at risk. Throughout my career, I have referred to the programs in Title I and Title XI as the three-legged stool that serves as a safety net for U.S. producers. Agriculture Risk Coverage, ARC, and Price Loss Coverage, PLC, and the Non-Recourse Commodity Loan Program serve as two of the legs, while the Federal Crop Insurance Program serves as a third leg. Price Loss Coverage was established in the 2014 Farm Bill using the cost of production as a basis for setting a level of protection for each covered commodity through reference prices. PLC rates worked fine while inflation was fairly low. However, the reference prices are in dire need of increases to remain relevant. Producers' costs have increased substantially, and the current reference prices are not providing a relevant amount of protection. Agriculture risk coverage was also established in the 2014 Farm Bill. ARC uses a five-year moving average of historic prices and yields to establish a benchmark that is used to determine the level of protection producers receive. While good when coming off of relatively high prices, ARC proved worthless when prices declined and remained relatively flat. Since ARC has a reference price embedded in the calculations, raising reference prices will make ARC attractive as a revenue protection safety net alternative. Assuming these two alternatives are used going forward, instead of forcing producers to pick the tool, ARC or PLC, they want, I would suggest allowing them to receive the benefits of whichever is higher in a given year. This would cost nothing more than if producers have chosen wisely. As I have said many times in front of Congress, do no harm to crop insurance and stop outside interest groups from trying to tie provisions of their pet projects to crop insurance. For example, linking climate change practice adoption to insurance program subsidy levels. While this hearing is about the Farm Bill, I would be remiss if I didn't mention the last 5 years of ad hoc disaster assistance. I believe the upcoming Farm Bill provides an opportunity to help address some of the shortcomings that ad hoc assistance was designed to address.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The June report contained relatively minor adjustments to estimated U.S. and world production, consumption, and exports for corn, soybeans, and wheat. The market reaction to the report was pretty muted. On Friday, new crop futures prices were up 4 cents for corn, down 14 for soybeans, and down 1 for soft red winter wheat. This price reaction reflects limited information available in the report and elsewhere about the size of the U.S. crop, particularly for soybeans and corn, as the late 2022 planting season's just now wrapping up.
Dr. Joe Jansen is a University of Illinois ag economist looking at USDA's World Ag Supply-Demand estimates.
Markets will closely follow weather conditions and crop progress over the coming months and reassess planted acreage estimates around the upcoming release of the USDA NAS acreage report on June the 30th. Broadly, the overall supply and demand situation remains tight, especially for corn and soybeans. Estimated stocks-to-use ratios at the end of the 2021-22 marketing year sit at 10% for corn. This is a historically low level that has resulted in elevated price volatility. Corn ending stocks-to-use have been below 10% in the United States in only 6 years since 1990. Production estimates remain largely the same from last month. Corn and soybean acreage and yield are unchanged in the June report. USDA stuck with its slightly below trend yield estimate for corn of 177 bushels per acre. There was a small change on the usage side. While most usage categories were unchanged, old crop exports were adjusted lower for corn by about 50 million bushels, leading to a similar increase in ending stocks. On the soybean side, the soybean supply and demand situation remains extremely tight. Estimated old crop ending stocks are about 4.6% for soybeans. U.S. soybean ending stocks use has been below 5% in only 5 years since 1990. Soybean production estimates remain the same as in the May report. Soybean exports did increase by 30 million bushels relative to May. That change resulted in a similarly modest adjustment in ending stocks lower, which does tighten the supply and demand balance for soybeans just slightly. On the wheat side, wheat acreage is unchanged and projected yields about 0.3 bushels per acre higher. So a slight increase in U.S. production for the coming 22-23 marketing year. The report did not include strong reactions to drought conditions in the southern Great Plains and excess moisture in the Dakotas and Minnesota.
If we talk about exports, though, Neil Fisher, the administrator of the North Dakota Wheat Commission, says,
that shift to non-tariff trade barriers is something we really need to address. And these protectionist moves sometimes look like they're masquerading as legitimate measures, either in increased food security in some areas, sustainability goals, or guard against some other threats that sometimes have very little basis in science. We're pleased to hear about these nominations. We want to move that portfolio further ahead. We had seen past administrations do quite a bit of work in the area of new trade agreements. We think the UK, not a layup by any means, but might be one of the most doable prospects, if we can call it that. In Africa as well, there are some opportunities there, 100 million ton grains market there, probably a longer term project, but something that could move forward on that agenda as well. The other areas that we have found work that could be done, I think, in an effective way, in Indonesia, Malaysia, more of this Indo-Pacific area that we've made great success in, those are growth markets in our top 10 customers. I think if we had a few more resources to work with in MAP, FMD, we could move further, faster on those kinds of things. We're big proponents of value-added in biofuels. In North Dakota, we're going to do some more of that kind of work here pretty soon. I think balancing our energy portfolio with all of the alternatives, whether it's fossil fuels, that we're pretty good at in North Dakota as well, the biofuels aspect, there are new technologies here, the new generation. I think this is something that's very, very exciting.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
To provide context for my testimony, it is important for you to understand the environment in which I work, the nation's grazing lands.
Michael Vance with Southern Reds in Gainesville, Texas, testifying recently before a House Ag Committee.
Grazing lands are one of America's greatest natural resources. They account for more than 650 million acres and represent roughly 41% of the continental U.S. They contribute more than $70 billion annually to the U.S. economy by supporting over 60 million head of cattle and almost 10 million sheep. To sustain agricultural production along with nationwide food security, grazing lands must be properly conserved and managed. This management starts below our feet with soil health, which is the foundation of our operations. The ecological function of these lands begins and ends with soil organic carbon. Soil carbon directly contributes to decreased erosion, improved drought tolerance, vigorous plant root growth, decreased need for synthetic fertilizers, and improved water quality. Unfortunately, the Green Revolution that began in the 1950s was premised on an oversimplification of a complex biological system. It applied a one-size-fits-all approach to increased production. Since that time, our agriculture industry and the research to support it has focused solely on the chemical and physical characteristics of soils with little to no consideration of biological interactions therein. The consequence has been an ongoing degradation of our soil. Over the last 60 years, this approach to agriculture has resulted in a loss of more than 50% of our nation's soil carbon. Our soils today have diminished water holding capacity, are more susceptible to erosion, and are dramatically less productive. In response to these circumstances, I, as well as many other like-minded producers, have abandoned what are now referred to as conventional agricultural processes. We learned the hard way that these practices are too reliant on expensive inputs such as herbicides, fuel, and fertilizer. This is neither ecologically nor economically sustainable. Alternatively, we have adopted a regenerative approach of working with nature by following six soil health principles. They include understanding our context, armoring our soil, minimizing soil disturbance, increasing biological diversity, keeping living roots in the ground all year, and most importantly, properly integrating livestock. Grazing lands evolved with animal populations equal to or exceeding modern livestock populations. The fertile grasslands and rich soils of this country emerged in part due to the seasonal migrations of enormous herds of antelope, elk, and bison. These lands benefited from the impact of animals browsing, grazing, trampling, and recycling nutrients through saliva and urine and manure. Their grazing and movement patterns created a natural disturbance benefiting the soil, plants, and the ecological processes. This is the same process regenerative ranchers like myself are successfully recreating today. In doing so, we are restoring our soil health, increasing our production efficiency, and restoring profitability to our operations. We are accomplishing this while supplying our growing nation with a healthy, nutritious, and enjoyable protein supply. These are complex ecological systems. The impact of a changing climate on our agricultural productivity is equally as complex. Research is needed to enhance our understanding of these complexities. Unfortunately, the academic research standard of replicated short-term or reductionary studies is ill-suited to address these issues. These studies attempt to isolate and analyze a single issue within a complex and variable ecosystem. This scientific approach cannot account for the ever-changing environment facing our farmers and ranchers. We need a new and different approach to agricultural research that transcends the normative boundaries of academia. We need researchers who are willing to partner with producers like my family and so many others who manage their production systems as an entire ecosystem so that we can better implement new conservation practices without damaging our long-term profitability. But even further, we need research to assist us in addressing changing consumer needs, volatile weather patterns, serving local markets, and managing socioeconomic well-being and resilience in rural America. There can be no sustainable food supply in this great nation without having profitable producers working on regenerated soils.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Right now, process-wise, I think the single best idea out there is the Trust Act. Senator Romney has worked on this, and it's bipartisan and bicameral.
Concern hasn't yet hit panic levels, but Maya McGinnis with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget says answers are within reach.
And what's so appealing about it is that everything is on the table. In order to get out of the special committees that would look at how to save these programs, the proposals have to be bipartisan, and you would still have the same threshold in the Senate to pass any reforms. So there's no single right way to make Social Security solvent. However, the wrong thing to do is to continue to do nothing. So we would be delighted to work with any office that's interested in working on Social Security to develop a plan for solvency. We would be particularly interested to do so that anybody's willing to do it on a bipartisan basis.
Mike Braun is a senator from Indiana, member of the Senate Ag Committee and Senate Budget Committee.
I've been here a little over 3 years, and I recall the first budget hearing that I was at. Senator Mike Enzi was the chair then. And when you keep hearing the same thing over and over again, it gets tired to listen. I agree that there are certain priorities we have as a government. I'd say defending our country would be up to attending to our infrastructure, which we all share, and entitlements. I think it's hard to make the argument that we do not need to keep this whole and healthy. But I also recall from that discussion that nothing ever gets done because there's no political will here to do it. On decisions like this, where you're dealing with a situation a lot more complicated now than it was even 3.5 years ago. We were $18 trillion in debt when I got here. We're 30. And imagine we got a blueprint out there that says we're going to be $45 trillion in debt in 10 years. That's not the context that any of this is going to work within, other than an academic discussion. That lack of political will of trading off spending for this versus that, which you've got to do everywhere else in our society. It's laughed at when you would ever use the metaphor of households. Let's use the metaphor of state and local governments. They have guardrails that force political will into doing what needs to be done. All I can tell you is we're not evolving into a place to where we're going to be able to do any of this, and it's going to go way beyond Social Security. Medicare Trust Fund goes broke in a little over 4 years.
That could probably be extrapolated to ag budgets as well. Dr. Joe Outlaw with Texas A&M.
Aside from price, weather concerns around the country are still making it where some crops are not even in yet. So the producers that we deal with reach out to me on a daily basis talking about the fact of individual instances of not being able to get different inputs, whether it be chemicals or nutrients. And this is a real challenge, and it's going to prove to be a challenge. Farming is an extremely difficult thing to do, even though they make it look easy at times. Mm-hmm. And if we have any kind of weather blip, we're going to not have the yields. And as was stated earlier, we're going to have even worse price situation than when we thought.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The WASDE report also contains updated forecasts of the season average price received by U.S. farmers for corn, soybeans, and wheat, and other commodities.
Dr. Joe Jansen is an agricultural economist at the University of Illinois and is looking at the latest USDA World Ag Supply Demand Estimates report.
In the balance sheet given here, and as can be seen in the report, the season average price for 21-22 for wheat is estimated to be $7.70 a bushel. For the coming marketing year 22-23, the season average wheat price is $10.75 a bushel. This average farm price is a marketing year average of the prices received by U.S. farmers across the country. Observed and forecast spot market prices for different times of the year get different weights in calculating this average, with the weights depending on the previous five-year average proportion of farm output sold at that time of year. So typically, the marketing weights are highest immediately following harvest and smaller at other times of the year. While these forecasts play some role in informing price expectations, an important, well-defined function of the season average price is serving as a benchmark for Title I commodity programs under the 2014 and 2018 farm bills. Farm program payments under the price loss coverage and agricultural risk coverage programs are based in whole or in part on the difference between the actual season average price and levels defined by the program. In the June WASDE report, USDA increased its 21-22 season average price for corn to the level seen on the graph here of $5.95 per bushel and left its estimated new crop average corn price at $6.75 a bushel. These small changes are typical. Month-to-month changes in season average prices are often small relative to the day-to-day changes in cash and futures prices because the season average price represents an average across the whole year. As seen on the graph for 2020 and 2021 crops, a typical seasonal price pattern results in the season average price being a combination of lower harvest time prices and higher prices later in the marketing year. The June WASDE report did also increase the 21-22 season average price for soybeans by about 10 cents to $13.35 per bushel, as seen on the graph. New crop soybean average price forecasts were 30 cents higher at $14.70 per bushel, the level seen just on the right edge of the graph here. The graph also shows past and current season average prices relative to the underlying spot price for soybeans. Current 21-22 and 22-23 season average price forecasts indicate that prices are relatively high compared to previous years and relative to the policy support levels defined by the PLC reference price. Farm program payments based on the season average price, then, are pretty unlikely in the 22-23 marketing year. For wheat, USDA left the season average price forecasts unchanged in the June report. Comparing historical season average prices to spot prices, as I've done in these graphs, shows that the season average price often masks considerable intra-year volatility in prices. Prices can be well above and well below the prevailing season average price. Prices can fall and increase during the period around a given season average price. Though the June WASDE report contained limited news about agricultural commodity supply and demand, it highlighted continued tightness in U.S. supply and demand situation for corn and soybeans especially. Low inventories indicate the potential for future price volatility, including price reactions to future supply and demand news such as the pending update to acreage estimates on June 30th. Low inventories mean high prices, including season average price forecasts contained in the WASDE.
Again, that's Dr. Joe Janson, an agricultural economist at the University of Illinois. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Our North Dakota producers, as Senator Hovind has already outlined, rely heavily on exports and have actually developed durable export market relationships, which account for half of their annual pricing and income opportunity. That's a very big part of the wheat industry in North Dakota, but also in our much more diversified agriculture.
At a recent Senate Agriculture Subcommittee hearing on ag trade, priorities and issues facing America's farmers, Neil Fisher, the administrator of the North Dakota Wheat Commission, testified.
When I started this business, we were largely a wheat state, and now we have a very much broader base under us. The diversification is something that I think our fathers and grandfathers would have wished for. Our total annual value of production in North Dakota is roughly $10 billion with a B each year. And there are four main pillars. It's corn, wheat, soybeans, livestock, primarily beef cattle. But we don't raise many peanuts in North Dakota, but we have a lot of other very high value specialty crops like potatoes and sugar beets and peas and lentils and things like that that make up that very important other 20%. So a growing diversification there, all dependent though on trade. And so we're very much a part of that. In my earlier years with the Wheat Commission, we were struggling to find freight rates that would even get us to the West Coast, much less to Japan and the Philippines and places like that. Now that's where 70% of our goods go. And so that's something that it's still a very high cost operation. And our earlier commissioners used to say this is one of our highest transportation is one of our highest production costs. They included that with the fertilizer and fuel bill when they were figuring up how their income statement was going to look for the banker. So I think this is an interesting take on that. Those days are back with us now, even though we have those channels opened up. We have some very, very stiff competition in those markets, and we have high transportation costs. I think the energy situation has also exacerbated that. The Black Sea origins, compromised now by obviously the geopolitical situations and other things that are going on, but we're in the central part of the country. We have a long ways to reach water, and so those freight rates are a big, big deal. And as fuel goes up, so do the freight rates, whether it's here in our own country or getting across the puddle, as they say, to those destinations. Our goals are to continue to advance as far as we can, so market access, enforcement of the trade agreements we have. We heard a lot about advancing this agenda of the new nominees. I hope that goes well because we've been missing that for some time. We need that aggressive approach out there. Our involvement in trade policy was sort of tangential to our programs with the foreign market development, MAP, and those programs of the USDA's FAS. These cooperator programs have done a lot for us. It's been the backbone of the development. So funding that program as well, perhaps not so much in the trade policy arena, but also the backbone of how we move goods, how we promote them into the world market. So those are very important aspects of this all for us. We have the non-tariff barriers you just heard about. This is something that is very concerning because when I started in this business, we were doing tariff reductions. We'd knocked down a lot of that, become very successful in that arena. But we have since then slipped away, and now we have the non-tariff barriers with a tax on commonly used farm products, weed seeds that unrealistic limits and those kinds of things, and the MRLs, maximum residue levels, tend to take us apart in Vietnam and places like that where we're having a great success in moving into the Southeast Asian market. But these are the technical issues that continue to come up.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
World rice production is strong. Record strong.
For both the old crop year and the new crop year, we're looking at higher production month over month and an increase in production year over year as well of about 1.7 million metric tons.
With production from India the driver, according to World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jekinowski. Also on the rise, commodity use in the 2021-22 marketing year, particularly in India.
They're shifting more of their food assistance program toward providing rice instead of wheat, given the very high prices and tight supplies of wheat, relative abundant supplies of rice.
The tightening of ending stocks for both the old and new rice crop is the result. Yet Jekinowski points out that compared to other commodities, rice supplies
are still fairly abundant.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.